Crow, and I'm glad you're with me again. You can find us on facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. You can follow us on Twitter @theinfectiousmyth. And you can send me an email at any time to david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. Before I get to my guest this week, who is Christine Hildebrand of the Voice for Choice Organization in California, fighting the mandatory vaccination law SB 277, here's this week's feedback. From Martin Barnes by email: it was great to meet Brian Martin. There are a few professors like him who keep track of current dissidents across many issues and the various strategies used, both to promote dissenting causes or to hinder them. He's a valuable resource. And thanks for adding some depth to the sex culture wars. I thought the girl carrying the mattress was a slam dunk, then to hear what really happened. Well, I guess we don't know exactly what really happened, but I'm sort of with you on that one. Yolande via Facebook wrote, "I really love your show. Good information. I'd like to know if these kids who did the shootings are not mind-controlled, because they are all taking prescription drugs and their eyes look the same. Psychotic drugs are a form of genocide against our youngsters. It's a crime against humanity. I wish you could talk more about it. Thanks." My response to him was that until scientists can identify a single thought in a living human brain, there's no way that they can actually insert a specific idea, let alone a complete plan, such as going to kill people. On the other hand, pharmaceutical and recreational drugs can destabilize the brain, but you cannot predict whether the outcome will be suicide, violence against a person's family, or whether in the case of Dylan Roof, Sergeant Bales in Afghanistan, Adam Lanza, and many others, the violence will be against a group of people that perhaps they have a grudge against or see as subhuman. I would certainly like to have another guest to talk about violence stimulated by pharmaceutical drugs. And I do appreciate all listener suggestions. In fact, today's guest, Christina Hildebrand, is a listener suggestion. Michael via email said, "Since I heard one of your most recent broadcasts about the HIV hypothesis, I have seen other articles using the word hypothesis. I don't understand all of it, but I was surprised now that more scientists are talking about the HIV hypothesis. I also saw an article in Trends in Molecular Medicine dated June 2015 from Jay Levy, who's a famous AIDS scientist, dispelling myths and focusing on notable concepts. And then I saw a video about Dr. Robert Wilner, who seems very convinced that HIV is harmless. I don't know what I should believe or disbelieve. I trust my feelings and my healthy common sense. I don't trust doctors anymore. It's now 4 years ago that they told me I'm positive, and then I will die in 2, 5, 7, or 10 years if I don't take the drugs." Well, that's what we're really all about, Michael. We're about giving information and getting people to think more and make their own decisions about medical and other scientific issues. And now to our guest, Christina Hildebrand. Christina Hildebrand is the president of A Voice for Choice, which is opposing California's mandatory vaccination law, which was just signed by Governor Brown, which is known as SB 277. Welcome to the show, Christina.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great. So how did you personally first get concerned about the safety of vaccination?
So about 10 years ago, when I was pregnant with my oldest daughter, I did all the good things, you know, parents do when you're a first-time parent. I made sure I ate right. I made sure I was, you know, went to all the doctor checkups. I was on top of everything. And one of the things I wanted was as natural a home, birth as possible. I did have it in a hospital, but I wanted to make sure that I had a natural birth. And in doing that and in writing my birth plan, one of the things that came up was hepatitis B shot at 12 hours old. And I kind of looked at it and went, whoa, hang on a second. Why am I doing that? And I did, you know, I looked at it and was like, okay, does it need to be done at 12 hours old? No, it doesn't. All right. So let me look into hepatitis B. What don't I know about hepatitis B? Because what I knew about hepatitis B was that it was a sexually transmitted disease or something you got through, you know, needles, bodily fluids, basically.
Right.
Why does my 12-hour-old baby need this? And that really got the ball rolling. I realized then that, you know what, my 12-hour-old baby doesn't need this vaccine right now. So let me pushed that off, and we talked to the pediatrician. You know, we had conversations with the doctor. It wasn't, you know, my decision completely outright. And our conversation was, you know, is this absolutely necessary now? You know, I've done all these things to keep my baby safe and healthy and all the rest of it. It just doesn't feel right. And she said, no, you know, there's no reason for it to be done at 12 hours old. You know, you can definitely push it out. And so from there, I'm a researcher business wise. And so from there, you give me something to research and I delve into it. And I spent thousands of hours researching both sides of vaccines and really looked into it and what I wanted from my children and worked with our pediatrician on that. And so that kind of got the ball rolling. And I will say, you know, for the first 5 years of her life and then her sister was born 3.5 years later. So for that period of time, I was very, very engrossed in researching, right. researching vaccines and all toxins. I mean, really, you know, genetically modified foods, organic foods, right. what's in our water, what's in our air, all of those types of things. And so, that got the ball rolling. And then once my youngest was sort of 2 years old, it was kind of like, okay, you know, I've got this down. I understand what's going on. And then, you know, six months ago when this bill came forward, it really triggered everything off again and was like, God, we can't, you know, I did all my research 10 years ago, 5 to 10 years ago, but it's all coming back and we really need to do something to stop the government mandating a medical treatment, forcing a medical treatment on our children. And, you know, where does that leave us? What's the slippery slope that leaves us
so
with?
Let's talk a little bit about SB 277. So
sure.
This is the state of California, and mm-hmm. basically the law will eliminate most exemptions. It will eliminate the religious exemption or philosophical exemption. It will leave right. the medical exemption, which requires a doctor to agree to it. Mm-hmm. And there is some kind of period of time where there's kind of a grandfathering clause in there.
Yeah.
Can you give a little bit more information about this bill and its significance?
Yes, definitely. So I think one of the key things to note is that Assemblymember Pan, Senator Pan now, who brought the same bill in, put forward a bill and pushed it through the legislature in 2012 that came into effect in 2014, which was called AB 2109. And that basically said that if you have a personal belief exemption or if you want to have a personal belief exemption, that you had to go to your doctor and you had to talk about the pros and cons with your doctors of vaccines. And then the doctor would sign the personal belief exemption and that's what you would hand into school. And that only came into effect last year. It really only came into effect September 2014 with that school year. And what we saw was a drop of about 20% in personal belief exemptions. And that was the point of it. The point of it was to make sure that the people who had personal belief exemptions truly were consciously doing this and talking to their doctors and knowing the risks and the benefits of vaccines.
Which is a bit ironic because a lot of people who've researched vaccines actually know more
Absolutely.
About it than their
yes.
doctors.
Yeah, yes. And it is ironic. And, you know, I look at it and, you know, I went into my doctor and I said, you know, can you sign this, please? Because we've had the conversation probably 100 times, you know, probably not 100, probably 10 times because my kids go to the doctor once a year, but more when they were younger. But yes, I mean, we've had the conversation, and so it was a no-brainer as to whether she would sign it or not, right. because we've had that conversation. But that was put in place, and that was, you know, that basically was to ensure that people weren't abusing the personal belief exemption.
Right.
We have a personal belief exemption rate in California right now of 2.5%. So statewide, 2.5% of 5 to 18-year-old children have a personal belief exemption.
Right.
That's very low. That means the other 97.5% are either vaccinated or have a medical exemption. Now, the number of medical exemptions, I think, it's less than 0.5.
Right.
So we have a 97% vaccination rate in the state of California. That is high. That meets any herd immunity. It means, you know, anyone you right. talk to, that's high. I think we're 10th in the nation. So we don't have a crisis here. Come December, January of this last winter, we had the measles outbreak here in Disneyland, or that started in Disneyland, and that was cause for 111 bills in 36 states to be brought forward that have to do with mandating vaccines. Now,
right.
if you have 111 bills that come into place in 36 states in the same 2 weeks, you know that somebody is behind it.
Yes, it didn't just happen.
It didn't just happen. So Senator Pan came forward with SB 277. SB 277 basically took away the personal belief exemption. We never had a religious exemption here in California. The personal belief exemption covered the religious exemption. Basically, your religion is your personal belief. Mm-hmm. It stated that it would take that away and all you'd be left with was a medical exemption. It was amended through the legislature, and what we've ended up with, and I would like to talk about what happened in the legislature along the way. Yeah. What we ended up with is a bill that basically allows for parents to homeschool without having any exemption. If you have a homeschool, you don't have to show your vaccine status.
Right.
It allowed for children with IEPs, which are individualized education programs, to stay in public school or to stay in school for the amount of time that their IEP stated they had to be in school, which is a very gray area. And it'll be interesting to see how that actually works itself out, because it's up to the schools basically to determine what that is. An IEP isn't, you know, this child needs an hour of occupational therapy or speech therapy. An IEP basically says, you know, this child needs to be in the classroom 75% of the time. While they are in the classroom, they need to be speaking in three-sentence conversations. They need to be interacting with their peers 20% of the time. You know, it's very individualized per child.
But is it kind of a surrogate for a mental or physical disability? I mean, that's why you...
Yes, you have an IEP if you have a mental or physical disability. Basically, okay. if you cannot be in the mainstream classroom environment... And be in, if you're not a sort of, mainstream isn't the right word, but if you're not a child that can just sit in the classroom and go with what's being taught to you, so you may have some mental disability, you may have some physical disability, then an IEP is written, and it's an individualized program. So it's something right. that's specific to that child. So okay. it'll be in, so a child with an IEP can go to school, but for the amount that the IEP states they should be in school. So the question is, how does that really play out? And it's up to each individual school, I guess, to work that out. So it'll be interesting to see how that...
Well,
how
does an IEP... presumably they would apply throughout the child's entire school life. So if they start in elementary school through
yes.
high school, the IEP would kind of follow them and would be adjusted as time goes
Correct.
On.
Yes.
So if a child had an IEP, you know, had some kind of reasonably serious disability and had an IEP that got them through high school, then they would be exempt from this.
Yes.
But if say, they have a speech disability and in grade 5 they declare that the child no longer has a speech disability, that would terminate the IEP. And at that point, yes. presumably, they'd be covered by the law and would have to be vaccinated. Is that
Exactly, right? Yes. And then the other piece of it is this grandfathering in clause. So basically, if you have a personal belief exemption in, if you're in preschool,
right.
which the law doesn't actually address preschool. So, but it's been brought up and it's in the grandfathering in clause. So it's an interesting piece. But if you're in preschool, your personal belief exemption goes to kindergarten. When you enter kindergarten, you have to be in compliance with SB 277. If you're in first grade through sixth grade, you can keep your personal belief exemption until you enter seventh grade. At seventh grade, you have to basically process the paperwork again and be up to
right.
in compliance with 277. If your child is in seventh grade and beyond, then they have no then they're covered by the personal belief exemption and you're good to go.
And if you changed schools, basically if you change schools because you've graduated from grade 6 to 7 or whatever the split is, then you need to apply, you need to...
At 7th grade, you have to have new paperwork. If you change schools, say in 4th grade, then your personal belief exemption will follow you.
Okay. Now, I mean, one of the things that's going to lead to is that you know, a lot of people are going to say, okay, we're good, and then all of a sudden it's 7th grade, and now I've got... How many vaccinations could I be behind if I've gone 5 or 6 years without doing anything?
Right. So the total number of doses that are required by this law are 36 doses. It's not the full CDC schedule, but it's nearly all of it. So the you have to have the DTaP, which is diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, which is whooping cough. You have to have the MMR, which is measles, mumps, rubella. You have to have the Hib B, which actually is an interesting one because it's not recommended for children over the age of 5. So to get the Hib B is kind of obsolete. So that one, the question is, will your doctor give you a medical exemption for that one disease? Right. If your children are over 5. Polio, what are we left with? Hepatitis B, and I think that's, and chickenpox, varicella. And so those are the diseases that you have to be up to date. You have to have multiple doses of each of those. None of them are a one dose series. So you could be, the people that are going to be hardest hit are the people who have their kids, you know, selectively vaccinated or unvaccinated, and they're going into into kindergarten in September 2016 or into seventh grade at 2016. But, you know, when I look at this bill, the parents that are that now have a personal belief exemption are parents who have consciously made that decision.
Right.
They're not parents that are going to just roll up their kids' sleeves and say, yep, vaccinate them, get them up to date with all their vaccinations. They're parents that have made this decision. They're parents that have researched this. And for whatever reason, they have chosen not to fully vaccinate their children. The other thing that we should keep in mind is that the personal belief exemption, you could be completely, your children can be completely unvaccinated, or they could have 35 out of the 36 doses.
Right.
And they still had to have a personal belief exemption. And that was one of the things that we requested of the legislature, was rather than put through this bill, is to really look at those personal belief exemptions. Because although there's a 2.5% statewide personal belief exemption, there are pockets, there are some schools, there are some counties that have higher personal belief exemptions. But the question is, are those people with personal belief exemptions people who have had their children pretty much fully vaccinated but have chosen not to have the hepatitis B vaccine, for example, or the chickenpox vaccine? That's another one that, you know, many parents these days want their kids to get chickenpox, want them to have that natural long-time immunity. And chickenpox isn't deadly. You know, the chickenpox vaccine was created, if you look at the advertising when it came out, and the reason behind the chickenpox vaccine was an economic one. It was so that parents didn't have to stay home for 2 weeks while their kids have the chickenpox.
Right.
Great, that's fine. If you want to have the chickenpox vaccine, go for it. But there are other parents that want that don't want to have the chickenpox vaccine and want their children to actually have chickenpox. And so, you know, that there are, if you go through the list of diseases actually on this list, not many of them really make sense for if the goal of this bill was to make the classroom a safer place from a public health perspective. Not many of those diseases actually make sense.
I was born in the 50s, so I had measles, rubella, definitely. I probably had mumps. I had chicken pox. I had all of those things, and I never got 2 weeks off school. I mean, I guess that's the extreme. I think the most I remember spending in bed with a fever and spots was 1 day, maybe two.
Right.
my mother worked, so as soon as the spots were easily covered up, I was back to school.
Exactly. And I mean, in those days, we had measles parties, we had chickenpox parties, we had parties where, oh, you know what, your cousins have got the measles, let's go over and get them so that your immune system is boosted up, and you get them and you're done. And that's why they were called childhood diseases. And that's one thing that we've, you know, well, come back to the list of diseases, but one thing that we are failing to see is that these diseases, all of these diseases, the childhood diseases, the measles, mumps, rubella, chickenpox, I also had scarlet fever when I was a kid, but, you know, those diseases they're called childhood diseases because that's when you cope with them best as a child.
Right.
That's when your immunity can really rally against them and really, they're not bad or to deal with. Whereas if you get the measles when you're 25, 30, 40 years old, you're really going to struggle through it.
You just managed to come up with one measles death, which is highly questionable because the woman was vaccinated.
She was vaccinated, and
immunosuppressive therapy, the whole bit.
Yes.
So it seems like a scam to me.
They just
said we need to have a death, and this woman died, and so we'll call it measles.
But going back, go back to the list of the 10 diseases. You know, you have tetanus. Tetanus is not communicable by anyone. You know, you get it by stepping on a rusty nail or by soil particles, you know, it lives in the soil. Diphtheria is also another one that's a toxoid vaccine. It's not, you know, you don't get it person to person. Chickenpox we talked about. Pertussis, which is whooping cough, that one, there are whooping cough outbreaks and have been throughout the U.S., but what they found is 80 to 95% of the people who have whooping cough are fully vaccinated. So mm-hmm. even the proponents will say that vaccine just doesn't work. It doesn't work well. It wanes after a very short period of time, after about a year or two for some people. And so it's just not working. So for me, to mandate a vaccine that's completely ineffective is just, it doesn't make sense.
I mean, if there's 20% of people who effectively aren't protected, I mean, even it may be more than that, but let's say there were 20% of people who were vaccinated, but the for them, they weren't being protected. So right. to add another 1% of people who've got a personal belief exemption or right. something isn't going to make any difference.
Exactly, exactly.
The spread of the disease.
Right. And then there is, as I said, the Hib vaccine is recommended for under 5-year-olds. Mm-hmm. What else do we have? We have polio and then the MMR, the measles, mumps, rubella. And so, you know, if this legislature, when you have a law going into effect, you propose a law, what you want to have is that it is narrowly tailored. That's one of the premises of having a law and that it will hold up in court, is that it needs to be narrowly tailored. This bill was not narrowly tailored. It was, you know, we had that list of 10 diseases because that was added to, and when you had a personal belief exemption, if hepatitis B was on that list, you know what, no worries, I'll just have my personal belief exemption. But when you have that list and you suddenly are mandated to have that full list, you need to go back and look at that list and revisit it and see, you know, what actually makes sense in a classroom setting. The other piece that is on there is a number 11, which is probably the biggest issue with the whole bill, is that number 11 states that they can add, and they being the California state, and it's, I don't remember, there are three or four governing bodies that would approve it, but they're basically all run by the CDC. There's the American Academy of Pediatrics, there's the AMA or it's ACIP. Basically, you know, all the people that are putting vaccines in place are the ones that would approve this number 11. And number 11 basically states any other vaccine that they feel is determined is necessary. And that's the scary one. And right now you have a personal belief exemption on that. So one of the amendments that was made was to add a personal belief exemption to, if they add any other diseases, that you can have a personal belief exemption. But I can guarantee you that in the next 2-3 years, something will be added and it will go through the legislature and they will say, this is absolutely necessary because we've had an Ebola outbreak that yes. you have to have this vaccine on the list with no personal belief exemption
right.
through, and they'll push it through for whatever reason. So that the piece that says personal belief exemption is completely, you know, to me is null and void, because if they really want to put it through without a personal belief exemption, they'll put it through without a personal belief exemption. So
now, I got a question. Before this happened, were all of the vaccines that are on this list mandatory unless you had a personal belief exemption, or
yes.
were some of them? So hepatitis B is a mandatory vaccine in California?
Right now it is. You can have, it's not really mandatory because you have a personal belief exemption. So anybody right. can opt out of it. And what's interesting, if you actually on the California Public Health Department website, there's actually a slide that shows the number of personal belief exemptions in the state of California over the past, I think it's 30 years. And what it shows is that it's very, very, very even until, it was hepatitis B that was added. And then it had a blip up. And then it was again solid straight line until the chickenpox vaccine was added, and then it went up. And so, you know, to me, the two times when things have been added, the hepatitis B and the chickenpox, which are not, you know, they're not necessary to achieve public health in schools, though, when those two were added was when we saw the blip, you know, the sort of rise in personal belief exemption. So to me, it's the addition of those rather than that we've got a crisis and people are using this personal belief exemption and abusing it. And, you know, it's running rampant. I mean, even if we get all of those 2.5%, and most of them, I would say, are already vaccinated, but even if we got those 2.5% vaccinated, it's not going to change the public health in our classroom.
No. No.
If you have a child that, you know, in most classrooms, there it is at most, in most classrooms, there's zero people who have personal belief exemptions throughout
right.
California. But if you have one, if you have a personal belief exemption in your school, in your classroom, it's at most one, maybe two children. It's not a huge number of you know, it's not like half the class.
Right. But in places where there are a high number of personal belief exemptions, mm-hmm. what's I think is interesting is my understanding is those tend to be areas, high income areas. Are those yes. hotbeds of childhood diseases?
No. And that's what's interesting. You know, you look at the measles outbreak from Disneyland. First of all, we only had 131 cases of the measles in the state of California, which is an incredible number, a good number, given that measles is so communicable. You know, it is a highly contagious disease. And so 131 people getting the measles in the state of California, which has 40 million people in it, is tiny. It's absolutely tiny. And of those, 24 children, there were only 24 school-age children. None of those school-age children transmitted it in school or got it in school. So even if this bill was in place, it wouldn't have changed that landscape. What we found is, if you look at the number of measles cases, is it's very geographically based. So the majority of the measles cases were in LA, Orange County, and San Bernardino County, because that's where it happened. And they were those three counties actually have, I think they're about a 1.5 to a 1.8 personal belief exemption. So they actually have low personal belief exemptions. There were two cases that made it up to Marin, mm-hmm. which Marin has a high personal belief exemption. I think they're at about 6.5%. Those two cases, if we were going to say, yes, personal belief exemptions correlate with high disease, we should have seen 100 cases in Marin alone.
Right.
Than down in LA County, because in LA County and San Bernardino, you've got very few personal belief exemptions. And so it just doesn't equate. There is no correlation. There's no that you can't. And then there are other counties further north that had much higher rates and didn't get any measles cases. Yeah. So yeah. To me, you know, it doesn't make sense. And if you look at our classroom, there are so many. If you look at our classroom and you're worried about your child getting sick in the classroom, your child is much more likely to get sick from the common cold, from the flu, from other diseases going around like foot and mouth disease or, you know, unexplained stomach bugs or...
Let alone getting hit by a car or something like that.
Right.
Or shot with a gun. I mean, there's so many...
Right.
I mean, there's 30,000 people in America every year get killed in auto accidents and 30,000 by guns. That's like way higher than any
communicable disease. Yeah. And they, you know, the proponents will say, well, it's because vaccination rates are so high that we have that. And yes and no. The big reason why our disease doesn't spread, why those measles cases didn't spread more, was because of the quarantine and isolation procedures that we have in place for vaccine preventable diseases and non-vaccine preventable diseases. In the U.S., we have a good quarantine and isolation procedure in place. And if you get sick with a contagious disease, that's what happens to you. You get quarantined. I mean, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and there was an employee of LinkedIn who was exposed to the measles, didn't end up getting the measles, but it was exposed. They closed down the office for 2 weeks, had everyone working from home doing conference calls and stuff, because that's what quarantine and isolation does. Right. And what's interesting, there's a case in 2011 in Quebec, Canada, had similar high vaccination rates, and they decided, you know what, we've got high vaccination rates, we're not worried about it, we're just going to let the measles go, we're not going to use quarantine and isolation procedures. And they had over 600 cases of 678 cases of the measles in that outbreak. And so to me, and the other thing,
and
with
that
the,
was a fully, a pretty much fully vaccinated population.
Yes. Yeah. And the other thing with the personal belief exemption is, when you sign your personal belief exemption, you also sign as a parent that if your school has an outbreak of something that your child is not vaccinated for, that you will pull your child out of school for 21 days or until the outbreak is over. That's your quarantine and isolation procedure right there. That's the procedure that happens in order to stop the transmission of disease. And so when we look at this bill, it isn't necessary from a public health perspective.
Right. Well, can I go back and talk about Dr. Yeah. Pan a little bit, because I want to get into this. I called him Dr. Pan because he's an MD, right?
Yes, he is a pediatrician.
Pediatrician, okay. So
why did you put him up on this,
on this pedestal?
On this bill.
On the Pan pedestal. Now, there was an article, I think, in the Sacramento Bee that showed that Dr. Pan had received more money from pharmaceutical companies than any other any other politician in California. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes.
But the newspaper concluded that it had nothing to do with vaccination. And did you understand what they were saying about that?
I think because there were some people on that list that also got money from pharmaceutical companies and voted no on this bill. So you could not make a clear distinction that that money equals this bill. I would actually like to see in the next 2 to 3 years what his numbers look like, because I'm guessing they may not have given it to him in advance, because it would make it, I mean, he already is the top number, but I would like to see what he gets in the next 2-3 years from the pharmaceutical companies for having done this and having pushed it through, because I think that will be probably more telling than his numbers already are telling, but I think it will probably be more telling. I mean, then the other thing is, you know, their poster child, Rhett Crowett, who's this sweet little boy who's, I feel sorry, has been pulled into the middle of the whole thing. But he's a leukemia childhood cancer survivor.
Okay, so he can't be vaccinated because he's immunosuppressed, right?
He couldn't be vaccinated for a certain time while he was undergoing chemotherapy. He's right now up to date on his vaccinations. And, you know, he got cancer when, I don't remember what age he was at, but, you know, he would have been vaccinated up until, if his parents believed in vaccinations, he would have been vaccinated up until, you know, the time he got cancer. So he wasn't fully unvaccinated either, because he didn't get cancer till he was, I don't know what age, but, you know, not in infancy kind of
right.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the important thing to note with him, which is not put out in public media, is that his grandfather is a consultant for GlaxoSmithKline on one of their vaccines. So, you know, there's a conflict of interest there as well. So it really, to me, the whole bill and you know, you ask, where does it come from? Do I believe it comes from the pharmaceutical companies? Absolutely. There wouldn't be 111 bills in 36 states put forward to mandate vaccines without pharmaceutical companies being behind it. That doesn't happen in legislature. Could it happen in California? Yes, but not throughout the nation.
These stories, there was a very similar thing happened in Canada, where there was this woman who had this sob story about vaccination in the newspaper about, you know, her child had cancer and couldn't be vaccinated and everybody else was a risk. And turned out she was the daughter of a pharmaceutical executive. I mean, was this actually a real story, or is this kind of, like, is an email going around, like, if you have any family members who have cancer or any other reason they can't be vaccinated, let us know and we'll make sure it gets into the newspaper. And we won't identify that this is actually a relative of a pharmaceutical executive.
Yes, I have no idea, but it just all seems very, it all seems very uncanny. You know,
these stories are very powerful. I mean, it's like people are heavily motivated by a sad story about a child. I mean,
it's innate in humans,
right? You see a hurt child, you want to help them.
Exactly,
and they know that.
Oh, it definitely was the sob story. And it's partly, you know, we have, I will say I was very cautious and very, I questioned myself a lot when we have our own little wonderful little child who's been Otto Coleman, who has been paralyzed from the waist down, because of a vaccine reaction. And, you know, we have him, we haven't publicized him as much, because I just, you know, it's not a clean game. I mean, I don't want to bring kids into the middle of this. You know, did we have Otto there at our rallies? Absolutely. Because his parents wanted to say, look, this is our child. He's the same age as Rhett. This is our child. This is what happened to our child. But at the same time, I look at it and I just, you know, I feel for them, and I'm not the type of person that wants to put a child in the middle of a political game. It's just not right.
What's they're going to say, well, it's just coincidental.
Well, he actually has documentation he has documentation, but not. They will say it's coincidental.
They will. They'll say, okay, we compensated him, but it was just a coincidence. I was just reading the 1957 report on the polio vaccination field trial, and they documented some of these cases, a very small number of cases of paralysis that occurred shortly after vaccination. And then they basically just waved their hands over it and said, you know, just because, like in one case, they did an autopsy and they declared that this girl who'd previously been healthy before she was vaccinated and died had a congenital heart deformity. But it's kind of like they're looking for something, right? It's like, do an autopsy, find something wrong with this child, and then we'll blame it on that. Whereas if she had been unvaccinated and had, got paralyzed and died, they would have said, well, that's what happens when you don't vaccinate. That was clearly polio, right?
Yes, and there I watched a movie, and I now don't remember what it was, but they showed how the polio symptoms went down after the polio vaccine, but at exactly the same time, there's something else, and I don't remember the name.
I know this really well. What happened was polio, the big polio epidemic was in 1952. Mm. The field trial was in 1954. So by this time, it had dropped substantially. There was an uptick around 58, 59 when vaccination was getting rolled in, which may or may not have been due to the vaccination.
Right.
But by 1960, the epidemic of polio had virtually disappeared, and yet by that time, less than 50% of the American population had been vaccinated.
Right.
So it's very clear that the polio vaccine had very little to do with the elimination.
Right. But the piece that I found interesting, and I need to go research it a little bit more, but in this video, they showed that as polio was eradicated, there is another disease that has basically exactly the same symptoms of polio.
Flaccid paralysis.
That's it, yes.
And there are now around the world, according to World Health Organization's statistics, several hundred thousand or over 100,000 cases of acute flaccid paralysis around the world.
And
it's rising rapidly.
And that, you know, and so people, polio is gone, but it's just called something else is basically what the end game of that is. And so, you know, and they do that the government and the CDC does that very well. It eradicates something, but realistically, it's still there under a different name.
Well, and not only that, but at the time of the polio field trials in 1954, they had this thing called abortive polio, which was polio without any symptoms at all. And they had non-paralytic polio. So if you had a stomach upset or a fever or something like that, they would call it polio. Now, you know, polio is strictly a paralytic disorder. So the definition has changed dramatically since then. And, you know, it's gone, but we're still having kids paralyzed. And when the World Health Organization looked into it, they said one of the causes could be pesticides, other viruses, things like that. They don't really care about these cases of paralysis, or don't appear to care. They only care about eliminating polio, even though they're not eliminating paralysis. It's a weird situation.
Yes, yeah. It's definitely, you know, and polio is one of the things that they really... they used in the legislature, you know, everybody was just like, well, I remember the day when there was polio. And, you know, it's such a farce of what they're saying. And, you know, people bring up polio and it's just like, okay, hang on, let's get educated on polio here and what actually happened and what you just said, you know, actually happened.
Right.
And people just don't want to believe it. It was just such a hype at that time. And suddenly polio as polio's name has been eradicated because of this vaccine. And it's like, you know, if you do the research, that's not how it all adds up. It doesn't fully add up.
I'm actually doing an analysis right now of this of the official field trial report from 1957, which I got my hands on.
Once we're finished with that, I'd love to.
I will be doing a show on it, and I will also write it up. Like, here's a really fascinating thing about the polio field trial. In a few cases, they looked at absences from school in vaccinated and unvaccinated children, and they found a double the rate of absences in the unvaccinated children. But what's remarkable about it was that was the week before vaccination.
Huh.
So these two groups are obviously not comparable. And then after vaccination, the absences between vaccinated and unvaccinated was the same. So it's almost like they were doing some funny business with the absence list. Like, why would this group that has twice the absence rate the week before they're vaccinated, when nothing happens to them and their absence rate drops dramatically for the next 4 weeks? It makes no sense at all. And you wonder if they were manipulating the numbers or something. Like, how do you know?
Yeah, you don't know, and you never will know.
There's a lot of really weird things in that study. But anyway, that will come out later. There's somebody else I've in also interviewed several times a guy named Jim West in New York City who's done a lot of research into polio. And his stuff is worth investigating.
Yeah.
A lot of good stuff. So I wanted to ask if there's going to be a legal challenge to this law, like a constitutional challenge or something like that.
There will be. So we're working. So Tim Donnelly put forward a referendum. In order for that to move forward, we need to get 366,000 signatures in the next 90 days. I'm not sure that that's possible. I'm also not sure that I'm not opposing him doing that. I think somebody needed to do it just to show that we're pulling out all the stops.
Right.
I don't know that we'll get that. I don't know that putting it on the ballot is the best thing for us as a group, as a grassroots organization, because it means that we're going to get pummeled by pharma money in the advertising campaigns. And you know, I'm not sure that that
right.
If,
you might
if it
get...
happens, it happens. We'll deal with it. But it, yeah. You know, I'm not sure that it's the best strategy. But we needed to put forward the referendum to you know, show that we are pulling out all the stops. I don't know where that will go. We'll see in 90 days if we get the signatures.
Right.
But we will be for sure challenging this in court, and that's something that A Voice for Choice will be assisting with and raising funds for, along with a couple of other nonprofit 501c4s. But we will. There are various avenues. What we're looking for, you know, the law doesn't come into effect until until July 2016, and so that gives us. We have a year before we can do it because we can't go to court unless we have a plaintiff. So until somebody gets kicked out of school, we can't have somebody go
it's
to court.
It's going
to
happen pretty quickly. September 2016.
Yes.
Going to be a whole bunch.
Exactly. And so there are various lawsuits on various fronts. The constitutional piece of it is one of them. The California Constitution states that every child has a right to a free and public
right.
education. That's in our Constitution. And the Supreme Court has upheld that fear of contagion does not trump that. And so, you know, we and that's actually, you know, the Disabilities Act basically states that people with hepatitis B and with HIV can be in the classroom without giving any notice that they have those diseases because schooling is more important and those, you know, the fear of contagion doesn't trump that schooling. And
right.
so that's kind of where, that's one of the angles. The religious freedom is the other angle. You know, our First Amendment rights allow us religious freedom on all fronts. And there are people who are against vaccines for religious reasons mm-hmm. because of their ingredients.
I mean, that's kind of a two-edged sword because the way I see it is when the press covers people who oppose vaccines, which is not that often,
mm-hmm.
They love to pull up somebody who's got really fundamentalist or wacky religious beliefs.
Yes.
And they drag this person out and they say all
yep.
kinds of things that to the average person sound crazy. I mean, it's their
yep.
religious beliefs. That's fine. But to me, that's not the reason why people need to be skeptical of vaccines.
Yes, I agree with you. And so, yeah, I'm just saying, you know, we're looking at avenues. I'm sure there will be also a private school that will sue on this because it is damaging their, you know, as a private school, they're a private corporation. They shouldn't have to mandate vaccines
right.
that should be up to them. So I'm just saying there are many different cases that will come up and that we will, you know, right now what we're doing is we're kind of getting we have a legal team together
right.
and trying to work out, you know, what are the different avenues and what are we going to have most luck at putting this bill or this law, you know, on hold and changing it. So that's definitely something that we're looking at. As I said, there will not be a lawsuit until 2016, just because that's when the law goes into effect. There won't be a plaintiff until that time.
Have you thought about why the attitude towards vaccination is so hardcore? Like, it seems to me that if I want to criticize antidepressants, if I'm an MD or, you know, somewhat educated on it, I might be able to get a little bit of attention to it, and I won't be called like a total crackpot because I don't think antidepressants are useful or I think that they have side effects and they don't really help the depression. But with vaccines, it's become a completely black and white thing. You're either for
them
or against
yep.
them. And that's why is that the case?
Honestly, brainwashing. and that's, you know, you look at it and you look at, you know, our medical institutions, our teaching institutions are completely funded by pharmaceutical companies. They have been for 30, 40 years. And so those pharmaceutical companies you know, they basically have ingrained it into our doctors, into our pediatricians, into everyone that vaccines have saved lives. Vaccines are the best thing on earth. They have also, the pharmaceutical companies have also spread this fear, this absolute fear of contagion. If you ask a parent today, even who has had the measles and chickenpox and all the rest, they are deathly scared of their children getting the measles, the mumps, Bella. They are so afraid of their child getting sick that it's ridiculous. I mean, it's crazy, because those are the things that boost your immune system. The whole mantra of you get sick to boost your immune system. You get a fever because you're fighting something in your body, and that is building your immune system. And building your immune system is a good thing, because it allows to fight things later on that are much harsher, that are, you know, your immune system's like a muscle. The more you exercise it, the more likely you're not to get sick in the
future. But in order to exercise muscles, you also need nutrition. And one of the things, for example, measles is associated with vitamin A. And diphtheria, I think it's diphtheria, is associated with low iron levels.
Right.
So you'd think that there would be people like the state of California saying, well, we need to, you know, make sure that there are no children with low vitamin levels.
Yes.
You know, do a survey of the population and see if there's certain groups that are malnourished in that. Because those are the ones who are going to be vulnerable to measles, even if they're vaccinated, if they're severely malnourished because their diet is really bad or something like that.
And the other thing that we have to also remember is that in 1986, Congress passed the National Childhood Immunization Act. And what that did was it took away complete liability from the vaccine manufacturers. So you cannot sue a vaccine manufacturer if you have a reaction to a vaccine. What that did was it allowed the vaccine manufacturers to push these vaccines and to, you know, at that time, I think there were 7 doses that you had to get. And that's what you and I got, about anywhere between 5 and 7 doses of vaccines. We didn't get a huge number. We're up to now, between the ages of 0 and 6 years old, there are 49 doses of vaccines recommended by the CDC schedule, and 69 by the time you're 18 years old. That is a huge increase, and it's because they have never been sued. They have never been. There's no way, if you have a reaction to a vaccine, there is nothing you can do about it, basically.
I think another problem is their desire for continually increasing profits. If you've got a 97% vaccination rate, let's say with any individual vaccine, say 95% or something like that, then you can't get more money by vaccinating more people, because there just aren't any more to vaccinate.
Yes.
So what that means is you have to add vaccines to the schedule. And at some point, that's got to stop, because there's only so many vaccines that people can take before everybody's getting sick from too many vaccines.
Right. Well, they have, I think it's 217 in the pipeline at the moment, ready to be approved, or close to being ready to be approved. The other thing I should say, there isn't no recourse if you have an adverse reaction. So if you are the 1 in a million that dies, obviously you're not going to be doing this if you're dying, but someone in your family is going to do this. If you have died, or if you have had a serious anaphylactic shock, which has resulted in permanent disability, then you can go to the vaccine compensation program, which is a government-funded, no-fault, no-juried court that you use government lawyers for, that, or government-approved lawyers for, that you basically can go. And I should also say that you have to have had that reaction within 2, 4, or 6 weeks of having the vaccine. It depends on the different vaccines as to what the schedule is. And the statute of limitations on it is 3 years. So it's a much shorter statute of limitations. But if all of those things apply, then you can go to the vaccine court and you can try your case.
Right. There is a problem, though, with that. I interviewed a guy named Wayne Rode, I think, who just written a book on the vaccine court, which is not really a court. Like you say, it's a quasi-legal tribunal. But it's no fault if your adverse reaction is on the list. If your adverse reaction is not on the list, then you need to get lawyers. Then it gets much more expensive. And they've been trimming the list. They've been removing
adverse. The list is so non-existent that it's basically, you know, yes, I agree. It is. And so that, you know, but and that's why people say, vaccines are 100% safe and effective. Well, they look like that on paper because nobody sued them.
Well, you know, there's still $3 billion in compensation since the late 80s. That's not...
Right.
Absolutely safe.
No, that's not absolute. I agree completely. But when you look at the adverse reactions that most people have to vaccinations are they have seizures, they have things like eczema, diabetes, and these are all things that are on the Guillain-Barré syndrome. You know, these are all things that are on the package inserts for some of the vaccines. If you have any of those reactions, they're considered normal. And so it's kind of like, I'm sorry, but my child coming home and going limp and then having seizures for 4 days, that's not normal. Yes. That's, you know, if any other drug did that to you, you would be suing the manufacturer. You would be absolutely suing the manufacturer.
And what's worse yet is this is to protect you against measles or chickenpox. Right. And the child could have come home with measles instead. And spent 2 days in bed with fever and spots,
right?
Drinking chicken soup or whatever, right. And then gone back to school completely normal, having missed a couple of days of school as the only consequence.
And having the benefit of it is having immunity for the rest of their life. They will never get measles again. And so, you know, to me, it was funny. I was interviewed by CBS Nightly News, and they. I had a 15-minute interview. They cut it down to 1 minute, It was actually a fair 1 minute that they gave me. They didn't choose the most mundane piece of what I said.
Right.
But I was talking to him, and he said, "Well, you know, your children are relying on other people's herd immunity." And it was the first time I really thought. I know people have said that, you know, in general, but he brought it to my children, and so it was the first time I really seriously thought about it. And I said, "You know what? Actually, I'm not." I am not afraid of my children getting measles because we live in the U.S. We have good nutrition. They are healthy kids. We have good health care. We have sanitation. If we were sitting in Africa and I was, you know, I was an African, you know, without any nutrition, without any sanitation, without water, then it may be a different story. But where my kids live right now, I'm not relying on herd immunity because if there's somebody at Disneyland with the measles and my child is not vaccinated for the measles, my child will get the measles. Regardless of whether 100% of the other people around them are vaccinated, my child will still get the measles. So herd immunity doesn't protect my child.
Right.
So
not absolutely. I agree. I mean, if it was a really deadly disease and the vaccine was actually proven to help, it would be a different matter. I mean, another thing that you came close to mentioning, I meant to say earlier, was that if you look at the statistics of a lot of the diseases going back many years, you see that the diseases did drop dramatically in number many years prior to the vaccination. You know, often by 90 or 99% of the drop was pre-vaccination.
Yes,
and yet
yes.
The vaccine gets the credit for the entire drop. And if the vaccine had come out in the 1800s for some of these things like measles, would that have eliminated measles in the 1800s? Or would it have made no difference at all because 90% of it is due to nutrition and other factors?
Yeah, I mean, there's a chart that I love to show people whenever I do talks about the, you know, presentations about this, is the chart that shows, you know, measles, mumps, rubella, scarlet fever, for which there is no vaccination, you know, all of the childhood diseases. And basically what it shows is there is just a huge drop. And then you look at where the vaccines were introduced, and these are in deaths, you know, where the vaccines were introduced and where those vaccines were introduced, there was no change in the death rate. You know, there's no change in mortality before or after the vaccines. And so, you know, to me, there's so much more going on. And you take something like scarlet fever. Scarlet fever similarly has been, you know, it's been eradicated and there is no vaccine for scarlet fever.
And there's no attention to it. Like nobody's running around saying, "Oh my God, we're going to have a scarlet fever epidemic."
Well, look at Ebola. We had Ebola and it was purely quarantine and isolation that stopped the Ebola epidemic.
Actually,
you know?
That's a highly questionable statement to say that we had Ebola, but that's another story. No,
okay. If we had Ebola.
No, even in Africa, because
yes.
Ebola is a hemorrhagic fever,
yes.
And there were virtually no hemorrhagic symptoms in Africa this time.
Let me say, whatever we had,
yes.
Whatever you want to call it, whatever that was, it was quarantine and isolation that's spreading, which is, you know, I mean, it's the same thing. If your kids have a cold at school, you're told to keep them home. You're not told to keep them home because they're really sick. You're told to keep them home so they don't spread it to the rest of the classroom. You know, it's that kind of thing that, you know, you just look at it and the vaccinations are attributed in a large part for getting the vaccine rate, getting the disease rates down. But realistically, we're actually, I feel, and, you know, I've talked to Susan Humphreys about this at length. We're in a place now where we've actually messed up these diseases and I'm not sure whether we can ever eradicate them because we are giving vaccines that are waning, even if 100% and get them, not 100% are immune after right. getting them. And so when we had childhood diseases like measles and everybody got the measles, when you grow up, you have it in your breast milk, you transmit those antibodies to your baby. So the baby isn't getting the disease while they're breastfeeding. And, you know, slowly, if you look at herd immunity, which is truly on a natural immunity level, so people getting the disease, if you look at herd immunity, at some point these diseases will have gotten eradicated because everybody will have gotten it. And you will have gotten to a point of the population where everybody will have gotten it, or the people that haven't gotten it won't get it, because there are some people that can be around people who have measles and the chickenpox and will never get it, just because of their immune system, the way their immune system works, or maybe they get it and they don't show the symptoms to it. But basically now we've got children, babies, who are getting measles, which never used to happen because their parents had the vaccination, and so therefore the antibodies aren't in the mother's breast milk.
Right.
And so they're not getting those antibodies for the first 12 months of their life, if they were breastfed for 12 months. They're not getting those antibodies, and so they're more susceptible to it. We also have, if you look at the California Disneyland outbreak, over 50% of the people who got the measles were over the age of 20. Which is something that's never happened right. before. You know, it used to be measles, you got measles when you were 5 to 9 years old, sometimes a little older than that, sometimes a little younger, but that was kind of the time you got these childhood diseases. And that's, as I said before, that's when you fight them the best. That's when your immune system is most ready to just go on the attack and build and use that muscle. And so for me, you know, the fact that we've got babies and over 20-year-olds, you know, older people getting these diseases, just makes me question what the heck have we done, because that's not a good thing.
Right. Well, we've come to the end of our time. It's close to an hour. So I would like to thank you for joining me today. Is there anything else you'd like to add in the last minute of the show?
I think probably the only other thing that I have to add is that we are, for all those people listening, we are continuing to fight against SB277. We do have a vigil up in the Capitol of a warrior, what we've called a warrior in white, basically somebody standing in silence. It's following the silent sentinels, if anyone wants to look up the history of it. But basically standing in silence to let the legislature know that we are not going away and we are continuing to watch them and we will continue fighting. There are two other vaccine mandates. SB 792, which makes preschool and daycare workers mandated vaccines for them, and AB 1117, which incentivizes Medi-Cal physicians to fully vaccinate children under the age of 2, that we are also still fighting. They're still in the legislature here that we are actively fighting. So,
and what's your website?
Our website is avoiceforchoice.org.
Okay, well, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you so much. Okay. Thank you.